Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our study of the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. My name is Doug Thompson, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. And please excuse us for our technical difficulties here. We need a sound engineer. I want to start today's program by asking everybody to remember why we're here, and Jesus' instructions that wherever two or more are gathered together in his name, there also shall he be. And I'm going to just pause here and ask Jesus to be with us, and each of us to be with each other and him this afternoon as we explore a study of his words. What we're doing here is both for our own learning and that of everyone involved. And I want to express my deep gratitude for the many contributions which have come from the audience over the months. This work is far more accurate, and certainly my own understanding is far better for that. And for those who are here for the first time, I'm going to provide a bit of a background on what we're doing here and what this document is. And those who are already familiar with this part can take a 5-minute break. I'm going to post a link to the document we're going to be reading from. And for those on the radio who can't see the board, if you go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com, DTHOMP74, you'll see in the top left corner, original dictation. Click on that, it'll bring you to this document also. Now, as most of you know, the course exists in a number of versions as a result of extensive editing and abridgment over the years. While anyone looking at the earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that it certainly needed some editing, some of the editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally much clearer. One reason for studying this material is that it gives us a clearer picture not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Helen and Bill, the context within which he said it, and sometimes a clearer idea of what he really meant. The earliest written record of A Course in Miracles is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notebooks and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. Hardly a week passes that someone doesn't ask me about other versions of the course, which are also advertised or labeled as in some way original. There are actually 6 different versions of the text of the course of which I'm aware, and 5 for which I've been able to obtain copies. Most of these have been published, and in most cases, the publisher claims each is in some way original. Inevitably, this can cause some confusion. So this document we're working with today is original in the sense of being what was originally written down by Helen Schuckman before any editing took place. What I've been doing over the past few months is going through the notes and identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext, and combining these two earliest and most original manuscripts. The resulting document, therefore, is not any one of the 5 known scribal versions, but rather a combination of these two earliest ones. It includes essentially all of the original dictation for which we have any documentary evidence. Now, some of this material has some rough spots. There's segments which were written down only in point form. There's sentences which were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need editing in that it's not a finished product. The notes also include some material written by Helen, some of her commentary, and some from Jesus specifically labeled as a private point and not part of the course. These outtakes, or sidebars, if you will, provide considerable insight into Helen's experience and often involve explanations of miracle principles, practical examples from Helen's and Bill's own life, and as such they can expand our understanding both of the course proper and the scribing experience, which resulted in what we know of today as A Course in Miracles. So today we're going to be doing some reading, some commentary, and discussion of this material. Last week we got as far as T1B41P, So we'll be starting at T1B41Q, which is the third part of the instructions on sex. We've already got the URL up there. So the basic format is reading and commentary. There's usually more commentary and discussion than reading. And while I'd encourage everyone to raise your hand if you have something to share, I'd appreciate it if you'd try to keep your comments focused on the topic and try to keep it under 3 minutes unless something truly exceptional arises, which sometimes it does. Deborah will be keeping an eye on the hands on the board, and she's like the moderator here. When she acknowledges your hand and drops the mic, then you can pick up the mic. Towards the end of our 2 hours, or a little less than 2 hours today because of our difficulties, we'll pause and I'll ask for questions again and make an attempt at summarizing some of the key points of the material we've covered in this session. So at this point, I'm going to hand the mic to Deborah and ask her to make her introductory remarks.
Hi again, everyone. Jesus says in these notes that you are a child of God and you were created to create the good, the beautiful, and the holy. And we are called here to be teachers of God, and we are called to be miracle workers under His direction. So help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today. If you will tell me what to do, only that I will to do, is our prayer to Jesus. So let's all come together with leaving all distractions aside and coming in with the openness of our hearts to fully receive the message that Jesus gifts to us. Amen. And if there's any questions anybody has on what Doug has already said, you might want to finish the intro to the healing circle. Okay, sure. Last week, it started out with 3 male and 3 females, which was really a nice balance of male-female energy. It just happened that way, where 6 of us sat. So what we do is, I'm talking about for anybody that just came into the room before, after I had initially said something about the healing circle. We have going across the world healing circle, where if you join as a healer who sits in the circle sending light and energy to recipients in the hub of the circle, you can do this in the comfort of your own home. And what you do is envision all healers, sitters on the list in a circle, a closed circle. And then all healees, hub participants are invited into the center of the circle. And what we do is maintain that, the approach. If you're of a Course in Miracles belief system, if anybody comes in with a different set of beliefs, they're very welcome and they can apply their own sets of belief. As Course in Miracles students, then I encourage, and you don't need to follow that, but I encourage to seek Jesus' guidance as a miracle worker. It's a fantastic time to practice and be ready and alert to Jesus, His instructions. So if anybody is interested in joining, shoot me an email at Realizing Health. I'll write it down here. Realizing Health, R-E-A-L-I-Z-I-N-G, H-E-A-L-T-H, thanks Doug, at hotmail.com, and put healing circle in the subject line so I can easily retrieve it from my junk mail. All emails that do not come into my box normally will go to my junk folder, so I could retrieve it easily that way. And I will include you on the list and get you up to date with this week's circle. This week we have right now 4 females and 4 male. Coming, so that this is really interesting that that's happening. Thanks, Maz. Okay, so if there's any questions anybody has right now about what Doug said, raise your hand or write Q on the board or something. Yeah, the equilibrium, eh? Eh, Maz? That's pretty wild. That's really sweet. Okay, Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, I just wanted to make a few comments about this topic of the instructions on sex. In previous weeks, you may remember if you were here, we were reading about how sexual impulses and miracle impulses are closely related and can be easily confused, and that the one needs to be turned into the other. The sexual impulse is best converted into a miracle impulse. There was considerable discussion on that. And Helen and Bill begin this section by saying they don't really understand. And so what follows is a more detailed clarification of the relationship between the sexual impulse and the miracle impulse, and how it is that inappropriate sexual impulses can be converted back into miracle impulses where they have their maximal healing potential. Okay, Deborah, here we go. And we're at T1B41Q in the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. Deborah.
Parentheses. Neither Bill nor I is really clear about how sexual impulses can be directly translated into miracle impulses. Close parentheses. The fantasies that I mentioned yesterday, parentheses, refers to discussion Helen Schuckman and Bill had, close parentheses, provide an excellent example of how you switch. Parentheses, now switch the pronoun references or it will be too confusing. Close parentheses. Fantasies, Doug, take it.
Okay, I just wanted to point out that this discussion that Helen and Bill had that's being referred to, there's nothing I've been able to identify as any record of it or specific fantasies that were mentioned immediately before. So I think there's something here that transpired between the three, Jesus, Helen, and Bill, for which we do not have a surviving record. And that's also, I think, what the pronoun references were being referred to. It's one of several bits of evidence that the transcript of the dictation that we have is not 100% complete. But what comes next is a wonderful explanation. And Deborah, here you go.
Fantasies are actually it's T1B41R. Fantasies are distorted forms of thinking because they always involve twisting perception into unreality. Fantasy is a debased form of vision. Visions and revelations are closely related. Fantasies and projection are more closely associated because both attempt to control external reality according to false internal needs. Live and let live happens to be a very meaningful injunction. Twist reality in any way and you are perceiving destructively. Reality was lost through usurpation, which in turn produced tyranny. I told you you were now restored to your former role in the plan of atonement, but you must still choose freely to devote your heritage to the greater restoration. As long as a single slave remains to walk the earth, your release is not complete. Complete restoration of the sonship is the only true goal of the miracle-minded. Doug.
Okay, the key line in there for me is twist reality in any way and you are perceiving destructively. And we must remember the context here, which is that of ego perception versus Holy Spirit's corrected perception and Jesus' efforts to help Helen and Bill and the rest of us learn how our misperceptions can be corrected so that we can actually see the real world God created rather than illusory worlds that ego made up. Fantasies, of course, are key to the notion of illusion. A fantasy is something that we know is not real. We are thinking it up, and it's often accompanied by wishes. We wish the fantasy were true, and we start projecting our fantasies onto reality, and the result is distortion, which Jesus is saying in this line, twist reality in any way and you are perceiving destructively. The distortion is actually destructive. And what we're destroying is reality. What we're destroying is truth through that. Reality was lost through usurpation, which means that our minds, our fantasies, usurped or took over reality and mistook the fantasy for reality, which in turn produced tyranny. And then there's that reminder of universal salvation, complete restoration of the sonship. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about that one. Deborah.
I wanted to share a fantasy and the result of that fantasy in a visual and energetic experience that I had that really blew me away and wasn't at all comfortable and really set off a domino effect of a lot of distortions for years through my life. And then I would really like it if we came back to the line that Carmen posted here. And Carmen, if anything comes up for you while I'm giving this account of this fantasy experience that I undertook, please, by all means, share. Okay, so it was years ago, and I was in a long-term relationship and with three sons with this man and one from a previous marriage. And it was very rocky. We were so very well plugged into each other, but with just a humongous amount of interference that went on for us that we couldn't pinpoint, but, you know, we couldn't get a handle on. And I was getting pretty much exhausted. I had my own business going. I was studying as a psychotherapist. I was raising my four sons, and I took that to heart, and so I wanted to make sure they were all fed well with organic foods, and I breastfed all my babies, et cetera, all of that. So I was really kind of taxing myself and wearing myself out, driving myself, and I wasn't at all in sync with my partner and felt he wasn't in sync with me. And I started to drift out of it. Well, I drifted out in my mind toward a friend of mine who I had met in high school days, and him and I really bonded well in a heart way, but we really hadn't explored anything at that point. And so I had made a decision within myself that if my partner had acted toward me the same way he repeatedly was acting toward me, a certain behavior that just absolutely drove me nuts, and I felt completely pushed away, the whole family. I felt that with my sons from him as well, although don't blame him. And, I mean, don't look at him that way. This is my story, okay? So I don't want anybody to I would request that nobody feed into anything different than what I just say here. So I remember saying to him, you know, I feel like I'm going to have an affair. I knew I was starting to have a fantasy, and I knew that I was starting to reach out beyond him, and sexually would come up between me and this other man. And it wasn't that I was looking for a sexual relationship either, so that was a bit of a confusion to me, but that's the way I was reaching out in my own immature ways inside myself. And I really realized in that process one thing, that what I fantasized I could make very real and draw into my life. And that was, I'm immediately going into a distortion somehow within myself, even though I really didn't understand it very well. But I knew full well that there was some kind of distortion that was going on. But I followed this distortion, and I did leave for a 3-week vacation to get away and stayed at this person's place, and he was across the country, and did get sexually involved with him, which was not at all something that was in sync with me or him, we did go there. But the minute that happened, or the minute, we shouldn't say the minute, during that process, that first initial sexual involvement, my partner came to mind so acutely, just clearly, and his spirit or his soul or whatever it was, just him in this energetic form, just tumbled off into the universe, and I screamed inside myself and screamed his name out. It just really took me aback. I did not expect anything like that at all, and struggled and struggled and struggled with it for years and years. And these passages in here kind of bring that really back to mind, because the fantasy was a very destructive area. There was not truth in the fantasy. That's not what the relationship was between me and this other person. We were not procreating. The whole sexual interaction between him and I wasn't feeling like we were at all connecting on a certain level. There was, it just, you know, it was a total distortion. Even though him and I were very much connected in a heart level, without any of that, we could not connect sexually that way. So the distortion even proved more strongly that way. So I guess that's just all I want to say. Hopefully some of this makes sense to somebody, and I'll leave it there. Okay, here's the mic, Doug, if you want it, or if anybody else wants it.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Deborah. I think it's a pretty self-contained account. If somebody else wants to make a comment, by all means, but I don't really have anything to add to what you said. I think you explained the situation quite well. So I'll hand you back the mic.
Okay. So if I was understood on that, it just seems like, I mean, it was, to me, it was a clearer thing in my history about the distortions of reality that fantasy really brings in. And you know, it was, I was able to give up fantasies, and not right then. I did play around with fantasies in my mind after that, but I became very acutely aware in areas in my mind. I have not completely given up fantasies on different ways in my mind, but I've become acutely aware of the destructiveness of the fantasies and the unreality of the fantasies in my mind, and what exactly that does, because we're coming from mind, so what that actually does in our day-to-day relating with ourselves and with other people. So I'm like to be careful with that and learn further and more deeply. So I'm going to go on reading with T1B41S. Sexual fantasies are distortions of perception by definition. They are a means of making false associations and Carmen, you had written, as long as a single slave remains to walk the earth, your release is not complete. I wanted to ask here, now when... how is that fitting in here? We're becoming a slave to our fantasies? Is that what that is speaking of right there? How is that actual line? When you wrote that, Doug was talking about fantasies, and I just wanted to see how that fit together in here. I'm going to let go of the mic. If you want to take it, Carmen or Doug, or...
I think one of the reasons why I put that up there is... It just really struck me, because what he's saying is, as long as one of us is asleep, none of us is completely released, including him, including all of the people, or all of the souls, rather, that we consider to be enlightened. And it just really struck me in the context of everything that it's being said there. It says you must still choose freely to devote your heritage. I thought that was a really interesting, your heritage, your complete lineage to the greater restoration. And as long as a single slave remains to walk the earth, your release is not complete. And then it goes on to say, complete restoration of the sonship is the only true goal of the miracle-minded. all of that really brought up for me the whole concept of Tikkun Olam when I first read it. The idea, the Jewish idea of the broken vessel that shattered from the love of God is seen as all of the souls that walk the earth. And Tikkun Olam itself means the restoration. And so it kind of just jumped out at me as this, it's pulling together concepts that are ancient about restoring God's creation to the way he intended it, restoring the sonship back to its oneness, the Tikkun Olam idea being the idea of bringing all of the shattered pieces back together. And there is this repeated holographic or holistic view of the sonship that is repeated in various places throughout the course. And it just, this is one of my favorite sections because of that, because it sees us as this, you know, this wholeness. And as long as one piece of the vessel is still missing from the whole, it hasn't decided to devote itself back to completion. None of us is complete. The restoration isn't complete. The vessel isn't complete. The sonship isn't complete. And it just, I just really love this section. So thank you for letting me have the mic for a moment.
Well, thank you, Carmen, for adding that and putting some emphasis on that last portion of the paragraph, which probably should be a separate paragraph. And I'm just going to add to what you said by pointing out that the structure of this segment, it begins with Jesus saying, I told you that you were now restored to your former role in the plan of atonement. But you must still freely choose to devote your heritage to the greater restoration. So the individual restoration of Helen and Bill through their collaboration with Jesus is not the end or the goal or the final objective. That reminds me of the line, it's the privilege of the forgiven to forgive. It's the privilege of the restored to participate in the greater restoration. And then this reminder that Carmen was talking about, as long as a single slave remains to walk the earth, your release is not complete. Now notice the different word there. Initially it's restoration, and now it's release. Release from what exactly is a little bit open to question there. But one of the things would be an implicit obligation that comes from the nature of our creation as parts of the oneness, that we have an obligation to all other parts. And that obligation is not fulfilled, we're not released from it until complete restoration of the sonship is finished. And then that last line in T1B41R, complete restoration of the sonship is the only true goal of the miracle-minded. So miracle-mindedness implies sharing that goal of the complete restoration. So it's not about me. It's not about my finding inner peace. It's not about an individual healing for my problems, after which it's done. The goal is the complete restoration of the sonship, and the means is the restoration of each part. So as each part is healed, each healed part can spread healing and restoration to the rest, which is a very, very interesting model that Jesus presents here, and as Carmen mentioned, in several other places, of an obligation we have to each other. Wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there also shall I be. Salvation comes from relationships, from two. It doesn't happen alone. And until everybody is included, it's not done, and our job isn't finished. And the call of the Holy Spirit upon us will not be concluded until that work is complete and everybody is back home. This is quite a diversion from the topic of sexual fantasies, but it's appropriate because really what we're being told here is that the sexual fantasies destroy are destructive to this universal restoration. It's not so much that they're destructive to ourselves, though they are in that sense, they put us into a deluded state, but they're destructive to God's plan for the healing of all. And that is a very important few sentences occurring at this particular point. And also, I mean, the emphasis there's an emphasis on you still choose freely. You must still choose freely to devote your heritage to the greater restoration. So that participation in the greater restoration is something we must choose freely, which also implies we can only choose freely, which implies we can choose not to, which implies that even after we've been restored, in choosing not to help others, we can essentially cancel the benefit to ourselves. The healing is not strictly about us individually. All right. I'm going on at some length there. If there's anyone else who wishes to comment, by all means, raise your hand. For anyone on the radio who can't see what's being posted on the board, I'm going to remind you that you can find the document we're reading from, which is a combination of the shorthand notes and the ur-text, at www.miraclesinactionpress.com, DTHOMP74. And just click on original dictation in the top left corner, and it will bring you to this document. And then you can search for T space 1 space B space 41S, which we normally just describe as T1B 41S. And in your browser search button, that will...
You dropped the mic, Doug. Did you want to continue saying that, or you're finished?
I was just thanking Carmen again for drawing attention to that important little bit. Here you go, Deb.
Yes, thank you very much, Carmen. And thank you, Doug. I'm going to commence with reading T1B 41S. Start with it again. Sexual fantasies are distortions of perception by definition. They are a means of making false associations and obtaining pleasure from them. Man can do this only because he is creative. But although he can perceive false associations, he can never make them real except to himself. As was said before, man believes in what he creates. If he creates a miracle, he will be equally strong in his belief in that. The strength of his conviction will then sustain the belief of the miracle receiver. Doug.
Okay. Readers of this document will note there's a lot of footnotes which show up in the online version in square brackets underlined. You can click on the footnote, read it, and then click on the footnote you're reading, and it'll jump you right back to the spot in the text you left, so you can dart back and forth between them. Many times in the early chapters, and a few times later, Jesus will say, as was said before, as he does in this paragraph, or as we previously discussed. And to the best of my ability, what I've done is track these particular discussions, as was said before, and the footnote will point to the previous time, well, point to where it was said before, so the reader can, if you wish, sort of join the dots. Because you'll notice there's a kind of spiral going on in this discussion where the same topic is returned to again and again and again, a few pages apart. And sometimes as you look down the line of all the comments about a certain topic, you can see that he's weaving one story into another story, and you can follow it through in several different ways and explore just a, you know, one segment, one specific topic within the larger context where it's being linked in with other topics, which can be actually an extremely interesting exercise in terms of extracting, okay, what does he have to say about, you know, this specific concept? And you'll find that the relevant quotes are scattered all over the place. It's not all in one section. And that each time it comes up, he'll be putting it in a different context, and the context provides a deeper and larger understanding, so that towards the end of the text, if we've been following it, we have a very big idea about, for instance, what man creates, which is being talked about here. The idea that man believes in what he creates. We create illusions, and that's why we believe in them. This is, I think, the third or fourth time this idea has been mentioned. It will be mentioned many more times. And this first chapter is a bit like a table of contents in which a huge number of topics are addressed or stated or described with a little bit of description in the context of some other explanation. And then that topic will be later in the text expanded very massively, such that by the time we get to the end of it, our understanding of these points is vastly larger. Initially, it can be a bit confusing because the ideas are coming pretty quickly, though in the original dictation, they're always coming in the context of some kind of explanation of some sort of human phenomenon. Whereas as the material was progressively edited, the explanations disappear and we end up with simply 50 points in two pages, where initially we had 60 points padded with 100 pages of explanation. That's one of the differences between the material as it was originally dictated and the material as it was published in 1975. And yes, as Lee is writing, Jesus answers a lot of thoughts that Helen was thinking, the relevance in her life at the time, and he actually explains why he's doing that, that he is putting the new information he's giving her into the context of information she already understands, in contexts within which she already understands it, to help her with the disequilibrium or sense of uprooting that occurs when one adopts a new thought system, to acting as kind of a bridge and also providing a context to help her understand, her and Bill, because examples from Bill's life are also used quite liberally, to help them both and individually and together have a very clear understanding of the ideas he's trying to present as they are presented. Okay. Deborah, here you go.
Before I commence reading, I left an important detail to what I had shared, and I consider it important because it kind of validated, it did validate to me at the time that there was some kind of a soul disturbance that had happened because of my choice of actions that I was quite out of sync with. And that was, I was explained to a friend of mine who was very aware in areas, in energetic areas, and I explained what had happened, and she said, her response was, she found it very interesting because she had an abortion one time. Then during the abortion, at the time they removed the fetus from her, in her mind she saw this, which she considered the soul of the fetus, go tumbling off into the universe. So it was the same scene energetically, the connection of this person tumbling off into the universe. So I'll leave that at that because I still to this day don't draw a conclusion other than that there was a miracle that was going on between me and this other fellow, and I could feel that so strongly just in the presence of us being together, and it was a very healing experience just to to go there and be with him, but the direction that I went with it was not conducive to the healing of the relationship between my partner and I at all. In fact, it created a lot of pain and distortion and difficulties that went on for years that we've come to terms with, which is great. So, okay, here we go, even though we're not together. Here we go again with T1B41T. No fantasies, sexual or otherwise, are true. Fantasies become totally unnecessary as the wholly satisfying nature of reality becomes apparent. The sex impulse is a miracle impulse when it is in proper focus. One individual sees in another the right partner for procreating the stock. In parentheses, Wolf was not too far off here, close parentheses. And also for their joint establishment of a creative home. This does not involve fantasy at all. If I am asked to participate in the decision will be a right one, too. Doug.
Well, I think this is a fabulous paragraph in terms of Jesus talking about the appropriate use of sexuality. And it starts off with no fantasies are true, sexual or otherwise. By definition, a fantasy is not true. It's something we made up. It's fiction, in essence. It's fiction. But these fictions become unnecessary if we are perceiving correctly, when our perception is correctly, because the nature of reality as God created it is wholly satisfying to the creatures he created. And now we get to this really interesting bit. The sex impulse is a miracle impulse when it is in proper focus. And the proper focus is defined. One individual sees in another the right partner for procreating the stock, and also for their joint establishment of a creative home. So this, I mean, what we're talking about here is boy meets girl, they fall in love, and they see in each other a right partner, both for making babies and for jointly establishing a creative home that will be supportive to both of them. And this involves no fantasy at all. That's real. That aspect of sexuality or sexual impulse is completely real. And essentially, we're also being told it's God-given. It's part of how we are created. And then he adds, if I am asked to participate in the decision will be a right one too. Which is another way of saying, ask me. Ask me on those topics. Deborah.
T1B41U. In a situation where you or another person, or both, experience inappropriate sex impulses, know first that this is an expression of fear. Your love toward each other is not perfect, and this is why the fear arose. Turn immediately to me by denying the power of the fear and ask me to help you to replace it with love. This shifts the sexual impulse immediately to the miracle impulse and places it at my disposal. Doug.
Okay. Fear. And inappropriate sex impulses. Now, inappropriate sex impulses are not further defined explicitly, but in the previous paragraph, we have a definition of an appropriate sexual impulse, which gives us an idea of what he means by inappropriate. And when that is experienced, know first that this is an expression of fear. And it means that your love towards each other is not perfect, which is why the fear arose. And then he calls upon the use of the psychological mechanism of denial. Deny the power of fear. In other words, remember that fear has no power except what we give it. It is nothing in itself. And ask me to help you replace the fear with love. And that shifts the sexual impulse immediately to the miracle impulse and places it at my disposal. So here is the answer to Bill and Helen's initial question in the simplest possible terms. How is an inappropriate sexual impulse translated into a miracle impulse? You replace the fear with love. You recognize that the inappropriate aspect is coming from some kind of fear that one or the other or both are experiencing. And that can be, for instance, the fear of lack, the fear of being unloved. Could be any number of things. So deny it power. In other words, turn to that fear, having recognized it, and say, you're not going to control me because you're just a figment of my imagination. And then turn to Jesus and ask him to help me replace it with love. I ask Jesus to help me replace my fear with love. And that shifts the sexual impulse immediately to the miracle impulse and places it at Jesus' disposal where it really can be used in a loving, healing, helpful way for one or both parties to this relationship. Deborah.
T1B41R. No, sorry, T1B41V as in victory. Victory, I got the right one. Then acknowledge the true creative worth of both yourself and the other one. This places strength where it belongs. Note that sexual fantasies are always destructive, in parentheses, or depleting, in that they perceive another in an inappropriate creative role. Both people are perceived essentially as objects, fulfilling their own pleasure drives. This dehumanized view of the source of the depletion or depleting use of sex. Freud's description is purely negative, in effect, as a release from the unpleasant. He also observed that the tension from id impulses never completely abates. Doug.
Well, here we're being given another definition of appropriate and inappropriate. Now, the fantasies, the fictions, not the realities, but the fictions, are always destructive in that they perceive another human being in an inappropriate creative role. Essentially, they objectify. Essentially, the sexual fantasy comes from seeing another as a body, principally or primarily, and not seeing the rest of the human being, the eternal soul that's there and that is available for relationship. Both people are perceived essentially by each other in sexual fantasies as objects fulfilling their own individual pleasure drives. So two people can definitely see each other's bodies as instruments for their own gratification or the alleviation of their own fears. And again, those fears can be highly individualized and widely variant, but common ones would be the fear of being alone, the fear of feeling unloved, the fear of being unlovable. And if somebody is interested in using my body to fulfill her pleasure drive, then that, while it's a counterfeit kind of love, it can trick me for a little while into thinking I'm being loved when I'm actually being exploited, which can lead people to addictive behavior in terms of being addictive to exploitation because they can't recognize fully the difference between being exploited and being loved, and they're afraid of being alone. So this dehumanized view is the source of the depleting use of sex. And then he comments on Freud's description, and that would be very relevant to Helen and Bill, who were students of Freud. But in order to really make that meaningful, we'd have to spend some time probing just what Freud had to say on that, and I think I'm just going to skip over that one for now. Lisa writes, to see the other as a body or as a soul changes everything with sex. Whether you see the other as a body or a soul changes everything with sex, yes. Sexuality looks very different when you are viewing a person you love as a whole person versus viewing a person as a body who might be available for my gratification. Very, very, very different. And the latter would be fantasy because it's not true. Even though it is true that we can objectify each other and use each other's bodies for physical gratification, that would be a fantasy use because we are not seeing each other as we truly are in that situation. We are essentially joining in a fantasy, a make-believe. Let's pretend. Let's play house. And while both parties may completely cooperate in the pretense, it's still a pretense. It's a fantasy. It's not real. And most of them, most of their being, most of their personhood has no role in it. The same way as if we perform in a play and we go out on the stage wearing a costume and waving my sword in Midsummer Night's Dream, where I once acted. It's a fantasy, right? It can be very engaging for the audience, but I'm not the soldier with the sword. The rest of me is ignored, and for the purposes of the play or the fantasy, that's appropriate in an art form, but it's obviously not true, not real. And those people dancing around on the stage are just putting on an act. And in the theater, we know that's what's going on. So nobody's really deceived by it. But we can do that in real life and actually deceive ourselves. We can essentially put on a costume and pretend to be what we're not because of fear and end up in a really destructive kind of transaction with other people, which will end up being very unsatisfying or the depleting use of sex. Deborah.
T1B41W. What he should have said is that the shift from miracle impulses to sexual impulses was debilitating in the first place because of the level of confusion involved. This set up a state in which real release was impossible. Note also that Freud's notion of sex was a device for introducing relaxation, which he confused with peace. Inappropriate sex relaxes only in the sense that it may induce physical sleep. The miracle, on the other hand, is an energizer. It always strengthens and never depletes. It does induce peace, and by establishing tranquility, in parentheses, not relaxation, it enables both giver and receiver to enter into a state of grace. Here his miracle-mindedness, in parentheses, not released from tension, is restored. Tension is the result of a building up of unexpressed miracle impulses. This can be truly abated only by releasing the miracle drive, which has been blocked. Converting it to sexual libido merely produces further blocking. Never foster this illusion in yourself or encourage it in others. An object is incapable of release because it is a concept which is devoid of creative power. The recognition of the real creative power in yourself and others brings release because it brings peace. And boy, did I learn this one well. Here you go, Doug.
Well, if you want to make a comment on that, Deborah, by all means do. What we see here it begins with the notion of level confusion, which Freud failed to recognize, that the real creative connection. The real relationship going on, even in a sexual relationship, is not a relationship between bodies. It's a relationship between souls. That is the reality. When two souls recognize in each other right partners for physical procreation and creative homemaking, then their bodies and souls are integrated, the body correctly serving the soul, their relationships on the soul level manifesting on the body level, and that relationship is described as a miracle. Inappropriate or fantasy sex excludes the soul and focuses on the body and attributes to the body creative capability, which it doesn't really have, and that blocks the miracle expression from the sexual expression, which causes a buildup of tension, which can only be abated by releasing the miracle drive, which is blocked by that level confusion of mistaking sex as a physical act for personal gratification, even if it's mutual gratification, as opposed to recognizing it as the expression of a soul-level connection. So sex is basically made the master of the relationship, with the soul kicked out, and the bodies are mistaken for being the creative agents, which they're not, and the real creative agents, the souls, are hidden away, and so tension and frustration builds up, and sooner or later the two people are going to be at each other's throats because the whole relationship cannot be satisfying to them, irrespective of how much physical pleasure they think they're getting from each other's bodies. So finally, never foster this illusion in yourself or encourage it in others. An object is incapable of release. And when you view another as an object, you're also viewing yourself as an object. This will be explained later in much more detail, but it's a critical element of this description that Jesus is offering. The object is incapable of release because it's a concept which is devoid of creative power. The object itself has no creative power. Only the mind or soul does. And it's the recognition of the real creative power in yourself or others, which is at the soul or mind level, not at the body level, which brings release because it brings peace and also peaceful, harmonious relationships or holy relationships. Deborah.
What I was alluding to, Doug, was what I had learned through that instance, that fantasy, replacing miracle impulse with fantasy, not understanding what I was doing and I wasn't a course student and I wasn't reaching out to Jesus at that point for anything other than prayer to my maker. I would do in prayer at times, but definitely not knowing to do that then. But it was such a cutting element in my life, and then that domino effect of result that took years to have that healing process even beginning, where there was an opening in for that healing process to even begin to happen between the partner and I that did have all these children together. So I can see. It just gives me that sense of so clearly if I knew what I know today and I reached for miracle mindedness in that interaction, that I could just see the whole difference, the possibilities, knowing the people that were involved, knowing the big, huge change it would have been and the shift that would have been able to be created then with the miracle, because the souls would be open to it, but there was that severing of our soul connections. Is what I kind of saw. So I'm going to go on reading here. At T1B41Z. The peace of God, which passeth understanding, can keep your hearts now and forever. The scribal function. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, well, that basically ends that section with a benediction quoting St. Paul from Philippians 4:7, "And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall guard your hearts and your thoughts in Christ Jesus." And just to summarize that very, very significant bit of teaching, the inappropriate sexual impulse is replaced by a miracle impulse when we recognize that the inappropriateness comes from fear, that fear can be replaced with love, and that Jesus can help us, and will help us if asked, replace the fear with love, whereupon the wholly satisfying nature of reality, of the reality of that relationship between two souls, will emerge. And if sex is appropriate for those two souls, they will realize that and be told that. And if it's not, there will be no further fantasy need for it, because the fantasy comes from fear. Once the fear is replaced with love, the fantasy dissipates. Now, I'm not reading everything on the board, but there's a couple of things I have noticed, and one was Carmen's comment a few minutes ago about we can use others as objects, but that's not a valid act. Yes, it might be reliable, but it's not valid within the confines of the definition of validity that Jesus has been using here, which is somewhat of a scientific definition. And it basically means true. And using other as objects would fail to recognize the truth of the others, and therefore it would lack validity. Lisa writes, "If there's no buildup of tension from resistance, is there a need to release?" Well, if there's no tension, I would say there's no need to release, insofar as release is related to releasing tension, but the tension comes from the misperceptions of souls as bodies, insofar as this discussion we've been dealing with this afternoon. Fantasy comes from lack. Fantasy comes from the belief that we lack, the illusion of lack. The illusion of lack tends to be a fearful idea. I don't have enough. That's kind of scary. I might go hungry. I might be abandoned. These are all fear ideas. And they promote fantasies. Fantasies of a solution to fear, which is basically our minds in isolation, our human minds or egos, inventing ways in which our fears might be relieved, rather than turning to love and Jesus for a wholly satisfying real solution. Because nothing we can invent can ever be as satisfying to us as what God has laid out for us in his abundance and plenty. So the belief in lack starts off as really a lack of belief in God, and then a fear that I won't have enough, and then a fantasy in which an illusory, destructive idea of how to get enough is imagined, which generally involves exploitations of others, which itself is what creates the tension. Because the miracle impulse, the exchange of love, is being blocked, but the miracle drive is still there. Even no matter how much we repress it, it's still there. And the more it's blocked, the more we feel tension, and the more we might feel fear and indulge in fantasies to try to alleviate the tension, which just takes us in a downward spiral of ever-increasing frustration and ever-increasing alienation, both from God and from the people we're relating to, because we are not seeing them as they truly are. And therefore, we're not seeing ourselves as we truly are, and we just get deeper and deeper into circles of confusion. Now, this brings to an end the third section on the instructions on sex, which in itself was an answer to Helen and Bill's question, but the question was about a previous instruction, which they didn't quite fully grasp. So those two bits really do go together in terms of completing the instructions on sex, which Jesus said every miracle worker must understand. And I think we can understand why the miracle worker must understand them, because I don't think there's anybody who walks the face of the earth who doesn't have and hasn't had a sexual fantasy or a sexual fear or a fear of lack, which has ended up blocking healthy relationships and the wholly satisfying nature of reality and leading us on a literally chasing our tails down a spiral of self-destruction and destructive relationships. The next section is about the scribal function, and this is also a kind of a correction and addendum to previously dictated material. And I'm going to hand it over to Deborah at that point.
I wanted to add in there to that experience that I shared that the element of miracle impulse was so strong, you know, not seeing it and getting confused in there, but it did not completely block the miracle impulse. It blocked a miracle impulse between my partner and I from taking place. That I can see. It did not block a sense of a miracle with inside myself, which I find very interesting because that is, I think, really important. So there was a sense of me having a connection of feeling loved by someone, and this was not in a sexual way at all. This was just being in the presence of this person and the caring that he had for me. It was very potent caring and very sweet caring. So that fed me and helped my heart to open and expand in ways that wasn't happening in that core relationship that I had. So there was a sense that there was a miracle happening, but also there was a miracle being blocked at the same time. The miracle happening in one aspect for myself, but the miracle blocked in another way. But then later on, I can see that where that fed into assisting another miracle happening too. So that's all pretty fascinating. I find it really fascinating. Lisa, here's the mic.
Hey, there's just a couple of things. One that just occurred to me just now when we were going through this, and it did not occur to me when I went through this before. And it was, I guess, prompted by Deborah's question about, so is sex only to procreate? And it was the realization that the ego can use that belief just as well by saying, oh, well, you know, the only purpose is, you know, I need to use the body just to make more bodies, but still seeing my brother as a body, you know, so I need to use this person, you know, I need to get married, I need to join with somebody else so that I can make, you know, have a family, and, you know, and I can say that I love this person, and they can say that they love me based on what we love, quote unquote, about each other, but truly not joining because we're seeing each other as a body. And so the purpose really, and the only difference that I see totally throughout everything, especially with sex, but throughout everything, is whether or not the perception is that I see my brother as a body, and that is my perception is that I see my brother as a body, or that I see my brother truly. And that happens with anything. I truly have gotten to a place in my own healing where sex is used, just the body is used, as just another, as it's a communication device. And if I am coming from a perspective of what can I get from, or how can this person do this for me, and I'm seeing my husband or my brother as a body, and I'm seeing him as a means to an end, I am thinking with ego, and I am definitely in fantasy, because I do not know my brother in that moment, and I do not know myself. Because as long as I see him as a means to an end, then I see myself as a body then, and as a means to his end. And in our attempt to join, there will always be that feeling that we're not fully getting there. There will always be that feeling that it's not fully right. You know, there's that awkwardness or something's not right. But when it's not about that at all, and when it's coming from a perspective totally from healing and from joining and from love, it actually could look like from the outside that it's two bodies trying to join, but that's not really what's going on at all. And the one thing I wanted to add before I drop the mic is that before, when Jesus had said, let me scroll up real quick, where he said, if I am asked to participate in the decision will be a right one too. And I remember when the Holy Spirit started asking me to ask him to be in everything, and that included the couple of areas where I really felt the most uncomfortable with including him into, and one of them was sex. And I had to when I was flying solo, quote unquote, and I had to when I was being with somebody else, I had to include him in it, because by my excluding him from it was my error, and it was by necessity, by default, I was going to see myself and the other person as a brother. And all of the stories that I had about my body being sexy or his body being sexy or my ability to perform in a certain way or his ability to perform in a certain way were all based on the belief that I was a body and he was a body. And so it's impossible to really join with all of that fantasy, with all of that drama, with all of that, with all of the stories between me and my brother based on the whole belief in separation. And so the last thing I'll say is that was probably one of the hugest healings over the longest period of time. It was one of them that had to happen, and it was very uncomfortable to the point where I went through periods of not even being able to have any sex, even anything, and then periods where, you know, to learn to see it rightly and to, in its true purpose, is to be used only and for the communication of love, and that's it. It has to be in just and only for that, and not for fear, possession, lack, idolation of, okay, well, this body is sexy because of the value I placed on it and the value I placed on my own. So thanks for letting me share, because this is actually a very huge topic for me, as you could very well tell by the amount of time I just took. But sex was not a neutral subject before, and it took a lot to get to that place where it could be fully useful for love and not for fear. So thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lisa. Yeah, I think sex is a huge topic for our our world, because I think we're very immature as a whole in our sexual development. We're babies actually developing. So, yeah. Deborah, here's the mic.
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Doug. Lisa, thank you for touching on that, absolutely, because that's exactly why I posted that question, because, I mean, we get to the point, in this a journey of illusion, that our bodies cannot procreate anymore. And yet, our sexual drive, our miracle drive has not diminished. So that's why I posted the question, because if that's all that it was meant to be, it could be a confusion, right? And I know that, the only time there's debate and confusion is when the ego is in there and the ego's driving it. And I know now, really, truly, I don't know the purpose of anything. I don't know, I'm just going through this stuff and I'm learning as I go, and I'm surrendering, everything that I had belief in, structure in, and I'm surrendering this to Holy Spirit, and I'm saying, lead the way, show me, teach me, guide me, because that's my purpose. My purpose is to awaken. And so I'm sorry, I'm rambling on. Doug's got his hand up. I'm going to let go.
Well, if I understand your question right, or at least one of the questions, it's the idea of the only valid use of sex is procreation. And what about people who are physically incapable, for whatever reason, of making babies? Does that mean that their sex is somehow invalid. And I'm looking for something we read a bit earlier. And I'm going to find it here. And it's T1B41T, where healthy sex is described, or where the sex impulse is a miracle when it's in proper focus. And one individual sees in another the right partner for procreating the stock, which would be specifically in the context of Wolf's work, making babies, a socially useful, evolutionarily necessary activity for some of us to engage in. But, he adds, and also for their joint establishment of a creative home. Now, creative home is something that two people procreate. They don't necessarily need to have sex to do it. But within the context of a loving relationship that is procreating or creating a creative home, the sexual element, the kind of bonding and communication that can occur in sexuality when partners recognize each other as whole persons, as souls, not just as bodies, can contribute to that creative home. And so I'm inclined, my own interpretation of it, my own feeling about that comment, is that the intent, Jesus' intent, is not to come out with a moralistic statement that thou shalt not have genital contact if she can't get pregnant. There's an awful lot of religious doctrine running around that points in that direction, and that idea could be wrung out of it. But within the larger context, I think that would be rather a gross misreading of what Jesus is telling us. And that the notion of procreation is not confined to making new bodies, but can encompass any kind of creative interaction two souls might engage in that is facilitated or enhanced through their sexuality. At that level, the sex impulse is a miracle impulse as well. And what's being created may not be babies, but it is still something loving, divine, and a genuine co-creation of the two of them in the context of a loving relationship. And I think that's part of the wholly satisfying nature of reality and does not involve a fantasy at all and is not, quote, invalid, unquote. And I'm just reading a little bit on the board here. Bonding, yeah. Sexuality does have functions, a number of sort of social, psychosocial functions, and one of them is bonding. And in terms of building a creative home, jointly, bonding, anything that contributes to bonding will contribute to that co-creative enterprise. So I think the issue that Jesus is getting at is the objectification, the attempt to use someone essentially as an object. Whether or not both people agree to it, whether or not it's between consenting adults who use each other to indulge their fantasies, what he's suggesting is that if people relate truthfully, really, in love, then the sexual impulse is a miracle, quite frankly. And otherwise, it's a fantasy, which is destructive. But that the issue of whether or not the sex act is going to cause a pregnancy is not the It's not the indicator or measure of validity in and of itself. Yes, this is a huge topic, and I see a lot of people have a lot of things to say about it. And if anybody wants to add something, feel free before we move on to our next topic, because this is huge for a great many people, and probably an issue for almost every human being who has ever walked the planet. Deborah.
Hey, Carmen, here's the mic.
Oh, thank you for giving me the mic for a few minutes. This is something that we could probably take the rest of the half hour in, because it's really important. Gecko, I'm not sure what your name is, but you said that for a lot of people, sex is love. Just coming from an historical and anthropological education, I can explain something that I think is really important. Part of dedicating our heritage to the restoration of the sonship is to understand that we have come through millennia of human experience where sex and love are synonymous. When you look at the ancient ideals of love, like Aphrodite symbolized the goddess of love, she was all about sex. The concept of romantic love is a relatively modern invention. It is a step in the right direction in our evolution, and it is still something that is something that has to be worked toward, because we have come into this incarnation with millennia of cultural and biological programming to be so controlled by this sexual impulse, mistaking it for love, mistaking it for that which will make us happy and fulfilled. And so absolutely, this is it's what Jesus is describing here is what we are focusing on, is this ideal of loving the person beyond any kind of sexual attributes that that person may or may not have. We have examples of people like Christopher Reeve and his wife, where their love transcended him becoming a paraplegic, and we see the value of that. That's not something that the ancients would have considered love. They would have called it something else. They would have called it devotion or duty or whatever. But to just understand that we're in a new phase of human understanding and evolution about what real love is and what satisfies and what doesn't. And we have come out of a phase where it was about survival of the species, and it was about sex and reproducing and having lots of children. And the idea that so many of us have that marriage is for life and all of that kind of stuff, that was part of the institutions for humanity when an average lifespan was 30 years. And an awful lot of my friends have had to resolve some conflict that they have over this, because they would have children and then they would end up divorced, and then they get into the spiritual life and they start looking at their life and judging themselves. And invariably, when they read this stuff in the Urtext on sex, they will understand that they came together with their partner to be the perfect parent for the children that they had. They recognize the value of the children they had with that person, and they understand that it wasn't a mistake that they chose that person. Those children were exactly the miracles that were expected, and the purpose of coming together with that person was fulfilled, and that's why the relationship ended, and they were able to grieve and forgive. And I've just seen miracles from this section, and I just wanted to share that for many of us, we've got a lot of guilt and self-judgment about relationships that ended, and to understand that, you know, it was a miracle, it was perfect, it happened, and to forgive ourselves if we grew apart from that person, and to understand that the children that resulted from that are exactly the miracle that was supposed to happen, that there was no mistake involved. So that, plus the idea that we're trying to overcome just an enormous burden from our heritage of mistaking or equating sex with love, is to understand that we've come a long way in just having this discussion. So our culture, especially here in the United States, is so focused on sex that it's something that is really crucial for us to understand. And I'm so glad that we have this material now. And I want to thank you, Doug and Deborah for giving me the time to just put in my two cents. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that contribution, Carmen. That is really great. And Maz and I have been having a little debate about the dating here, but somewhere between the 10th and the 14th century, the notion of romantic love entered Western literature. And I'm certainly not sufficiently familiar with Eastern literature to know, to even be able to comment on that topic with regard to non-Western literature. But prior to the idea of romantic love, and in most traditional societies, East and West, sex is about making babies and joining families, and marriages are largely arranged by parents, and sometimes they're even commercial propositions. And the role of the woman is to make babies and maintain the house, and in upper class circles supervise the slaves. And monogamy would be sort of an unusual phenomenon. Guys just screwed around. And children were an economic commodity, so you made as many as you could because they made you rich, or that was the perception. The idea of marrying for love is relatively new in Western civilization, as opposed to marrying for economic convenience. And the equation of sex and love has come to happen in Western culture within the last however many hundred years. And it's really interesting to note that, you know, Aphrodite, the Greek, and Venus, the Latin version of the goddess of love, well, the Greek word for that is Eros. And that was, the Greeks had four words for love. And Eros was strictly, I'm horny. I mean, it was sexual arousal is what Eros was about. It was physical. It was animal. It was body-centered. It was about exchanging bodily fluids. And love, in the sense that we use that word in English, of genuine appreciation for the soul of another, deep respect for another, friendship, affiliation, those kinds of things, that had nothing to do with it. It was strictly a sexual, you know, a word that pertained to sexual attraction and the procreative instinct, I suppose you might say. Now, it really becomes interesting in terms of the idea of marriage being associated with love, and the idea that the person I want to marry is a person I'm in love with, as opposed to simply sexually attracted to, or our families are economically compatible such that it would be convenient from an economic point of view for her family and my family to be connected in marriage. So our parents approve of the match. And with that comes something that, Carmen, you were just talking about, I believe, the confusion of sex with love, that somehow or other, if I feel horny or sexually attracted to someone, that must mean I love that person, or at least I want to convince myself I do to justify my experience of sexual arousal. And that leads to something really, really strange in the modern West, which is strange from an historic, cultural history point of view, which is the idea of selling Chevrolets with scantily clad women, an idea which has certainly spread to China. I just saw on the BBC last night an auto show in China in which all the new Chinese automobiles are adorned with scantily clad women. That somehow desirable or worthy or meritorious, which might be associated with love, lovable because it is virtuous or meritorious, well, that gets connected with sex. So if we can get someone sexually aroused by mounting or having a scantily clad woman sit on the car, then he's more likely to buy the car than he would be otherwise, which market research actually shows to be true. There's a reason why people advertise cars that way. It works, for male car buyers at least. And it works subconsciously and subliminally. I mean, nobody really consciously, well, I shouldn't say nobody, but I think very few men consciously think that if they buy brand X auto versus brand Y auto, they're going to end up in bed with the model who's advertising the car. But at a subliminal level, it creates an affection. So we get this blurring of love and sex, and which also spreads out into the economy in terms of people trying to sell commodities such as transportation devices with sexual innuendos, and doing so successfully, mind you. So that blurring can make it very difficult for us to sort out what really is love and where sex can be distinguished from love, because clearly we know we can love people without being sexually attracted to them or involved with them. I mean, I love my father, and I'm not sexually attracted to him. I also can say, in one sense or another, I love my new car, but I'm also not sexually attracted to it. And that blurring, given the what we've just been told about what a miracle is in relation to sexuality, can end up with people being very, very confused in terms of feeling of fondness or affection or attraction, seeing something admirable, something likable, something worthy, and where do you put the word love? And when it's boy meets girl and there's some erotic arousal going on, how does that fit in with it? It can end up being very confused. And in the modern world, this focus on sexuality in the marketplace, where, I mean, it almost makes sex into a god, a kind of deity at whose feet we must worship, that I must have a sexy body, I must be attractive to the opposite sex, that's good, that's worthy, that's noble, and anything else makes me unlovable, unworthy, second rate, which of course is fodder for fear, for the illusion of scarcity, that I don't have worthiness because I don't have the ideal body, which, as some of you will know, for young women in particular in North American society, those who don't have fashion model bodies, which is most of them, they feel like they're second-rate human beings because they're too tall or they're too short or they're too fat or they're too thin or their proportions aren't just right, like most human beings. And that notion that somehow or other being sexy is equated to being worthy generates for many people scarcity illusions, which create fears, which in turn can create things like sexual addictions and various sexual pathologies. So I just wanted to add that to what you were saying, Carmen, because I think you were touching on some really, really crucial, significant points in our understanding of, you know, individually, as we deal with this civilization and its hyper-sexualization and our own relationships and our own self-understanding of who we are in relation to all those forces and how we navigate sometimes treacherous waters. And on that point, I'm going to drop the mic.
Okay. I saw the mic go on at your name there, Crystal. Did you want to take the mic to have a comment? Here's the mic if you do. Okay. That must have been a mistake. Oh, okay, Bill. Oh, really? You were, all right. Do you have another handle that you come in on besides Bill? I mean, besides Crystal Ray? I think I identify you with another name. If nobody else has a comment to add in here, then I will carry on reading at, if that's cool with you, Doug. Okay. He said I'm bill free. All right. I don't get the joke. I guess I don't know the interaction that has gone on. So we're picking up here at 41, T1B 41Z. The peace of God which passes, I did read that. So we're picking up at T1B 41AA, the scribal function. There are only two short additions needed here. One, your earlier acute problem in writing things down came from a much earlier misuse of very great scribal ability. This was turned to secret rather than shared advantage, depriving it of its miraculous potential and diverting it into possession. This is much like the confusion of sex impulses with possession impulses. Some of the original material is still in the temple. This is why you became so afraid about Atlantis. Bill has his own reasons. 2. Retain your miracle-minded attitude toward Rosie very carefully. She once hurt both of you, which is why she is now your servant. But she is blessed in that she sees service as a source of joy. Help her straighten out her past errors by contributing to your welfare now. Special relationships, re Helen Schuckman, omission 1. Sorindison notes here, and it's T1B41AC-N1. Priestess, a brother has knelt at your shrine. Heal him through me. I have an idea that the shrine merely referred to the altar within, which the priestess served. I imagine that the communication form was direct, and the brother always nameless. I, the priestess, responded automatically by praying directly to God, standing with upraised arms to draw down a blessing on her brother, who knelt outside. Her response was completely automatic and impersonal. She never even thought of checking the outcome, because there was no doubt. I imagine there is still no doubt, really, except that the priestess can no longer ask alone. It was originally sister, not priestess. Helen Schuckman, question, re, past memories, answer. As long as you remember always that you never suffered anything because of anything that anyone else did, this is not dangerous. Doug.
Okay, that short little section is clearly a piece that was dictated afterwards as a kind of correction or addition. And all of that segment appears to me to relate to reincarnational issues. Beginning with your earlier acute problem in writing things down came from a much earlier misuse of very great scribal ability. I don't think that refers to anything in Helen Schuckman's 20th century incarnation. And there's several previous references that we've discussed on that topic. That this was turned to secret rather than a shared advantage. And it's also being connected to the confusion between sex impulses and possession impulses. And one of the four possession fallacies that we dealt with a couple of weeks ago was the one that contaminates sexuality in terms of the desire to possess the beloved. rather than have a relationship with the beloved, the desire to own, to possess. And there was people, there was things, there was animals, and there was spirits. And there's a connection here being drawn between that, And then there's this bit about some of the original material is still in the temple. That's why you became so afraid about Atlantis. Bill has his own reasons. I have no idea what that pertains to. None whatsoever. I can guess like anybody else, but I really have no idea. It really stands... I mean, there's nothing else in the recorded material from Helen that I've seen that I can connect to those three sentences in any way, shape, or form. And then in the second paragraph, Rosie, who I believe was a housekeeper employed by Helen and Louis, again, there's a reincarnational suggestion here that she once hurt both of you, which is why she is now your servant. And again, it doesn't seem to, my sense is that it's not pointing to a hurt that occurred in Rosie's 20th century incarnation or Helen's and Louis's 20th century incarnation, but something earlier. And then special revelation regarding Helen Schuckman. And then this is a segment not included in the air text where Helen talks about the priestess, or this is, she's writing a revelation, she says. That this is a special revelation regarding Helen Schuckman that she received. And in this revelation, she hears an instruction, priestess, a brother has knelt at your shrine, heal him through me. And she has an idea that the shrine referred to the altar within. And there's this whole priestess idea that suggests some suggestion that Helen had had a previous incarnation as a priestess. And then it finally concludes that segment with Helen writing it was originally sister, not priestess. So it would be sister, a brother has knelt at your shrine, heal him through me. Yet this sister has the role of the priestess because she's being asked to undertake the priestly function, which is draw down the divine for others. And then in the conclusion, this rather reassuring summary, don't worry about past memories or past life memories. As long as you remember always, you never suffered anything because of anything anyone else did, then memories are not dangerous. And that brings us to the end of that little segment. And if anybody wants to make a comment, pop your hand up. We've got 5 minutes left. And I'm just going to summarize briefly that we've learned today how inappropriate sexual impulses can be converted into miracle impulses, which is their actual origin. It's our fantasies and delusions that translate a miracle impulse into an inappropriate sexual impulse, and that comes from fear, and Jesus can help us replace the fear with love if we ask him. In fact, he asks us to ask him and says he can do that for us. And therein lies the healing for all concerned, and when we don't do that, when we pursue the inappropriate or fantasy sexual impulse, all manner of complications and difficulties arise in relationships, which make healing far more difficult and create, you know. Carmen does have a comment to make. Okay. In that case, I'm going to drop the mic. We've got 4 minutes left.
Go ahead, Carmen.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry if I interrupted. That was going rather smoothly, Doug. I'm sorry. There were several comments that I wanted to share. A brother has knelt at your altar. When I took that into meditation, what I got was the English translation of that for most of us would be someone had come to you for help. Altars are devotions, the Course tells us. Helen was devoted to psychology and at this point was starting to be devoted to the spiritual thought system in the Course. And so basically what he was saying was someone had turned to her for advice and help. I think a lot of us experience that, and that's what he's saying we should all do. Or Helen's revelation was giving us what we need to do when someone turns to us to help, for help, is to turn immediately to the Holy Spirit, to Jesus, whatever we're comfortable with, to get a higher form of help than what we, with our level of understanding and even our devotion to our disciplines, would be able to give them otherwise. Also, the business about Atlantis, I took that into meditation because Atlantis is kind of a controversial thing among anthropologists, and the more I see about modern discoveries and things, there is evidence that there was a higher civilization, probably higher than we experience today, at some point that was obliterated from the face of the earth. And this reference to things that are still hidden in the temple means that there's more ancient wisdom than has been revealed to date. And it's not so much a reference to did Atlantis actually exist as Atlantis per se, but this higher understanding of spiritual truth is still available and is going to come to light at a time when we can accept it and use it fruitfully. Also, this converting of the miracle impulse into the sexual impulse, this has just been so important in our study group's implementation of this section, is to understand that the miracle impulse is always there. It's always the desire to join. Just like babies are always reaching out to each other and to adults, that's our natural impulse, is to just reach out to each other. And it's the ego that always comes up and says no, that joining with another will cause us loss somehow, that it's dangerous. And so we pull back. And when we pull back, we have a tendency to convert that impulse into something else. We can convert it into anger. We can convert it into fear outright, or we do something like the sexual impulse, because it is so much easier for us as human beings to be naked physically with another person than to be naked emotionally with another person. We're so afraid to be penetrated. We're so afraid for people to get beyond our defenses and our walls and our masks, that sex is easier for us as a way of relating to another person than to actually be real with them and encourage them to be real with us. And with that, I'm going to let the mic go. Actually, it's 6 o'clock, but I'm going to let you finish up, Doug, and thank you so much for this time. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thanks, Carmen. And the summary there on the conversion of inappropriate sexual impulses to the miracle impulses is asking Jesus to replace fear with love. And in that section, we also find a description of appropriate sexual impulses, which are defined as miracles. So this previously we've read a number of things where the miracle impulse and the sexual impulse are being described as very similar. And here they're actually equated, that one kind of miracle impulse is the sexual impulse. But if it is contaminated by fantasy and fear, it becomes problematic, creates tension, creates relationship stresses and difficulties. But if it is corrected with love, then everything falls into place, and the wholly satisfying nature of reality as God created it becomes apparent to us. Concluded with that lovely benediction, the peace of God, which passeth understanding, can keep your hearts now and forever. And then that bit on the reincarnation. Yeah, I had forgotten about Atlantis, that Casey talked about Atlantis quite a bit. And Helen and Bill were familiar with Casey, so that may cross-reference with their familiarity with Casey's work, and apparently some fear associated with it. Beyond that, I really appreciate your pointing out that the priestess function, anybody called upon to help, and probably all of us humans are called upon by other humans from time to time for help, that brother has knelt at our shrine. Heal him through me, which pertains to both the first line of the course, you will see miracles through your hands through me, and the concluding lines of the gifts of God, which echo that concept, that our capacity to heal a brother comes from God through Jesus, and our hands are essentially his hands. You will see miracles through your hands through me. A magnificent, magnificent idea, and I had forgotten that connection there. So thanks, Carmen and Deborah. I'm going to hand the mic back to you for your concluding remarks, and thank you for the extra couple of minutes, Carmen, because we got started a bit late here through some kind of technical confusion.
Yeah, thanks, Carmen, for your comments. Very, very much appreciated. In fact, I'm going to listen over the tape and listen to them again. Doug, thanks very much for your devotion and dedication in doing this and doing all that, all the work that you've been crazily doing. I can't thank you enough. And thanks, everybody, for attending. It's been wonderful. This will be continued. Thanks to also radio participants out there. So this is to be continued May 9th. Sunday, that's next Sunday, 4 to 6 in the afternoon. Bye, everyone.